Look at this little backstage chatter.
Little backstage chatter.
Little this, little that.
That's okay, right?
Little something like.
Now it's time for Homegrown on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville with your hosts Clinton Johnston and Leslie M. Scott Jones, Charlottesville's only radio show devoted to local arts. And now, here's Leslie.
Well, it's not quite Leslie yet. Good morning, Sunday morning. Whether you are an art maker and an art breaker, an art faker, or an art partaker, welcome all, because all are welcome, of course, to Homegrown, show about local art. I'm the one they call Clinton, and I'm here with the woman who is refreshingly frank, but rarely a crank, Leslie M. Scott Jones.
Good morning, Clinton.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. I'm a little tired.
Are you?
Yeah. I had my signing for Bookends yesterday, and, you know, all that nervous energy, I'm pooped, man.
Really?
I am.
You should have gotten some coffee, because I'm thinking more about although our I'll share something with our listeners. Although our station manager said that he was getting a little tired of our coffee talk. He said, "Yeah, the joke's kind of running low." I think I'm starting to think about potential sponsors for the show. And
hey,
you
know what? Let's get Starbucks in here. Okay, let's get them in here. It's
like, yeah, get that Starbucks money, right?
Right? Yes, please. I have had 1.5 cups this morning, so
See, now that's the type of stuff that leads to promotion. 1.5 cups of what type of coffee would that be?
Well, this morning it's Sumatra. A very lovely dark roast. And hopefully, you know, the next 5 minutes it will kick in and I will be my...
Okay, and now I know everybody out there is thinking that she likes her coffee like she likes her men. Don't go there.
Get your... Hey, ain't nothing wrong with a little bit of dark chocolate,
it's
now.
It's Sunday morning. Get your mind right. Get your mind right. And I think that's a great way to ease into our parental advisory.
Yes!
Out for you people out there, parental advisor, at some point in this show, we may say the word allergen. Allergen. We may, as a matter of fact, respond vociferously, reflexively to the word allergen. So...
Because spring has sprung, ladies and gentlemen.
Sprung. So if you don't want to go and explain to your tender mercy to kids about the birds, the bees, and the pollen coming from the trees, then perhaps you might want to push them away before they hear us use the word allergen.
You know, you have a rhyming thing going on this morning.
Do I?
Yeah, you're rhyming everything this morning.
I'm a poet, and I'm not even cognizant of the fact.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. We over here being bougie and don't even know it. Oh, okay.
So let's head up to our first guest. Our first guest is an actor, a director, a writer, an educator,
a filmmaker.
She even did some stand-up comedy at one time. We have her here in her role as an author, Teresa Dalvest, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey everyone, hello, good morning. You're over here killing me. I've been on the air and I'm suppressing laughter between the two of you. I'm in tears right now. So it's a good joke. And yeah, I have my coffee, but you guys are better than coffee right now.
Aw, thank you.
You can just let those laughs go out, Teresa.
That's
right. I am now.
So we are here to talk about your new book.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate you guys giving me a corner of your time this morning to talk about the death of Cliff Huxtable. It has a subtitle, The Death of Cliff Huxtable, So We Can Survive Bill Cosby. And it's going to be featured in two events at the Virginia Festival of the Book coming up. Coming week.
So what, we all know what major social event prompted you to write this, but what exactly made you sit down and say, I need to write about this?
Oh, yeah. look, you know, being an African American person in their 40s, the work of Bill Cosby is like tightly woven into the tapestry of my life. Going back to the 70s, being a kid, waking up on Saturday morning, watching Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. In the 80s, looking at the Huxtable family on the Cosby Show, admiring them, seeing elements and nuances of my own family, but at the same time, seeing an aspirational version of Black America, to being a college student in the 90s. And even though I went to a PWI, I attended James Madison University in the 90s, every Thursday night at 8:30, the 7% of us at that school got together in the student union every Thursday night and watched A Different World. And so for at least 30 minutes, it felt like we were at HBCU because, you know, we were all there together. You could have been a freshman. Suddenly the seniors were talking to you. And that was the unifying factor of that night, of that work, and the legacy of Bill Cosby. Right. So then you.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about the legacy of Bill Cosby, because it's in the wake of recent events, I have found myself trying to explain to people what a fall, because that is to say, explain to non African American people what a fall that is. I don't think many people understood what, not just an iconic figure, but yeah, what a cultural touchstone. I mean, and I keep saying it, we called him Dr. Cosby.
Yes.
We referred to, I mean, the man had a PhD in physical education. We still called him Dr. Cosby.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's with that reverence and with that respect and that care and that love for his work, I think a lot of people, myself included,
Field of Beats every weekend. It's sure that still's only EDM on air.
94.7 FM.
It became, as more and more of the allegations of sexual assault and drugging women and you know, flat out rape in cases, with more and more of those allegations, you start to look at the person that you created, the person that we created as a public, because we loved his work so much. It's almost like we paste together this version of a person based on elements of all the different characters or you know, his lexicon of work. So when peeling back those layers and you get to this person, this fallible person who you know, if it's one, look, even if it's one woman and she says she's been sexually assaulted, I tend to bend towards her story or his story if he was sexually assaulted. If it's a person, I listen to the victim.
Right.
I give the victim the full benefit of the doubt, because that's really hard to make up.
Right. Statistically speaking, the victim is overwhelmingly almost always right.
Right. Exactly. But then when you start adding a second victim, a fifth victim, a tenth victim, you get up to 50 something, you're going, okay, something went terribly wrong somewhere.
right.
And so then you get into these battles, these confrontational, intellectual, spiritual, emotional battles with people who are having a hard time separating the characters he created from the man that he is. And you and when asked, do you know Bill Cosby? There was such an over. I started asking that question, is what it was, and there was an overwhelming realization that no, people have no idea who this man is, because whenever asked, they would describe Cliff Huxtable.
Yes,
and it's funny because when Eddie Murphy accepted the Mark Twain Award for comedy just back in the fall, He said, you know, he's really interested in all these comedians who think they can do an imitation of him. Like when they say, you know, Jay Farrow and Chris Rock and all these guys who come up to imitate when they do impressions of Eddie Murphy. They do the laugh,
Yeah.
They do a version of Eddie Murphy they've seen in movies. And he said they always end up doing Axel Foley.
Yes.
Because I'm not Axel Foley. And yeah, on occasion I laugh like that, because I don't even laugh like that anymore because it's become a part of a caricature.
Right? Yeah.
So with that as context, I just sat down and I wrote one blog piece. I just wrote one post on my website through the voice of Theo. What would it look like to kill off Cliff Huxtable?
Right.
And really start to create that divide. Like I can't do anything with Bill Cosby. He's a real person.
Uh-huh. Right?
But what has been given to us is this fictional character in this fictional universe. And it's clay. It's just moldable clay. So I wrote one blog post through the eyes of Theo. And Theo is coming home from the funeral. He's beat everyone home for the repast. And we hear him address his father out loud and discussing things like Black Lives Matter and why, even though he grew up in such a safe haven as the Huxtable home at 10 Stigwood, why is it that when he walks out the door, he walks into a world, a black man, and he's not prepared to be that guy?
Right.
He never learned what to do in the event that a cop pulls him over.
Because that was not part of that lexicon, right?
Yeah. You know, the show's last episode was the first night of the L.A. riots. And, you know, people were asked, I mean, folks were on television begging folks to go home, watch the Cosby Show, pacify your anger around the verdict for the Rodney King beating. The cops were acquitted of any crimes, to go home and watch the Cosby Show. And I remember that feeling and feeling like, okay, the Cosby Show is a pacifier. And so I really address that in this book, in a sense that, you know, when we are in a place of pain or hurt, we are given these moments where, you know, go dance or go sing or go watch a good TV show. And I wanted to kind of burn all that down with this book. So,
well, and it's also something that I think we as African Americans are, that kind of thing is pushed on us a lot. It's like, oh, why are you so angry about that? You know, you have this thing and you have that thing. Why do you need something else? Like, why are you still so upset about it? And
right. So
the fact that he was, and that show was, the pacifier for us for so long,
yeah,
makes it really hard, I think, for a lot of our community to sever the connection between him and his character.
Sure.
And it's really interesting that I think that's something the black community doesn't do well, you know, no matter what. I mean, look at OJ.
Mm.
I mean, there were so many people in the black community who were so on his side, even with all of the evidence presented.
So many people on his side and knew he was guilty.
Right. That's right.
I lived in L.A. during the, I was in grad school during that time period when the white Bronco went down the 405. I was at work, which was right by the 405.
And wow.
There was some chaos. But I remember the morning of the verdict. It was one of those mornings where I got a call from my mom, who was still in Virginia at the time, and she said, "Are you going to school?" And I was a grad student at Cal State Long Beach. And she goes, "Are you going to school?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, but I think they are starting to close down things because the verdict is definitely coming out today and they're anticipating some shenanigans." And so I go to school, and campus is a ghost town. And Cal State Long Beach is easily, you know, 50,000 people.
Right.
And it's huge. So I go on campus. It's a ghost town, but I see people walking towards the student union. So I go in the student union, and there are these huge two, these two large big screen televisions on two opposite ends of the student union. They were always there, but it was almost like now it's theater.
Yeah.
One side of the room were all the white students. On the other side of the room were all the black and Latino students.
No.
And when the verdict came out, you heard a hush, like a gasp, just wash over one half of the room.
Right.
And this cheer, like we won something.
Right.
Like it was like emancipation was happening all over again.
Yeah.
This other side, and people were celebrating and jumping up and down and crying and high-fiving, and then, you know, everyone dispersed, but people, you could see black and Latino folks walking across campus with their chests out, you know, poked out, and just white folks were just so dejected. And it was interesting to watch a whole room full of people who knew he was guilty.
Yeah.
Kind of embrace this moment of societal win, I guess.
Yeah.
Historical win in a way. And there's some of that with Bill Cosby. There's plenty of that with R. Kelly. We went through some of that with Michael Jackson. It's one of those things where when you really deal with the person as opposed to the good feelings they give you, I think then we can really start to address some of the hurt that these people are causing.
Hi, this is Jason Burke of the Six Pack Songwriter Series. You're listening to 94.7 FM, Homegrown.
So,
hold on, let me.
Oh, okay. Clinton's got to do something.
I got to do radio things. So that's right. Homegrown, 94.7 WPVC, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to us. We're here with our wonderful, wonderful guest, Teresa Dalvest. You're right. I do have this rhyming thing going on today.
See? I told you.
I didn't realize that. And she is talking about her book, The Death of Cliff Huxtable.
So what are the two events that you're doing? I know you have one talk at the App Festival of the Book.
Mm-hmm.
And when and where is that?
Yes. So Wednesday, the first day of the festival, I am doing a one-on-one sit-down with Marita Golden, who is an amazing writer. She's an essayist, a novelist, an award-winning editor. She's just awesome. She's definitely up there in terms of the readings and the work that she's done. She's up there with bell hooks in the nonfiction world. But she's also a great short story writer and fiction writer, and someone that I used to read in grad school. This is so exciting for
me. Oh, wow.
I used to study her work, and then I get an email from the festival saying, oh, well, you're going to do a panel by yourself, and it's going to be a one-on-one sit-down with Marita Golden. And I literally had tears rolling down my face because this woman, whom I respect, and I just gets me really excited. So 4 o'clock on Wednesday at City Space, downtown Charlottesville, the downtown mall. And that's from 4 to 5:30 at City Space. And it's just gonna be awesome. Marita and I got together a couple weeks ago. Sat and which was now I can get all my starstruck stuff out of the way.
Right.
Maybe not, I don't know. Starstruck, but I managed to do a lot of gushing and loving on her at this first meeting that we had a couple weeks ago to kind of get ourselves ready for the festival. So it's gonna be a great talk. The fact that we both love The Walking Dead and watch it. you know, we're kind of Walking Dead aficionados, if you will. That might even creep up into the conversation somehow because that's just who we are.
Yeah. And you're
so
doing
that's on Wednesday.
And you're doing another event in Earliesville, right?
Well, the Earliesville event is actually after the festival. There's a friend of mine's mom has a book club and they meet in Earliesville, and it's a pretty large group of readers, which I'm really excited about. And they've read the book, and so it's going to be a book club event in Earliesville. But the second actual VA book event that I'm doing is at the Lynx Brunch. The Lynx of Charlottesville is hosting a brunch on Sunday at 11:30. And, you know, it's an annual brunch that they give where they honor the African-American women who are presenting books at the festival. And so I'm one of those African-American women.
Look at you. Yeah. Hometown girl does good.
So, oh my goodness.
So Teresa, we got time for one more question for you. I just want to ask, we have talked to a number of artists on the show about how they use art as a healing device. We've seen people do that before. I think this is a unique situation to see somebody use art as healing. And at the same time, do it through, well, I mean, no pun intended, but a form of character assassination. It's fascinating to me. Why did you, I think you've talked about this a little, but why did you do this? Why were you pushed to approach things in this way?
I'm a growing fan of fan fiction, number one. Fan fiction isn't terribly new. It's a genre of writing that's growing because, you know, there's so many great stories and characters and universes out there where, you know, the fans would want to participate in that narrative and that storytelling. So from the approach of fan fiction, it just kind of came really easily with this book, primarily because I was such a student, such a fan of those characters and that family, that story structure and what they had to offer. So then why kill them off? It's almost like in order to truly do the separation, illustrating that, one, he's not a real character. I mean, he's not a real person. Sorry, he's a character. He's not a real person.
Right.
And until folks see the difference between the character and the man playing him, I think the conversation around sexual assault is going to be stifled because it's going to be overshadowed by the conversation of, well, Bill Cosby is America's dad. And no, he's not. He's the father of five people who are not celebrities and who are not people we are that well aware of.
Right.
And, you know, we're not privy to the life of Bill Cosby, but we are privy to the life of Cliff Huxtable. And with that access, I get to kill him off.
Right. And it's not just Cliff Huxtable, but it's also the character that Cosby himself played during his stand-up. I think frequently in situations like that, it's hard for people to see that is a character. But you know what it makes me think is it's almost as if through what Bill Cosby the person has done, these artistic representations that he's put out, Cliff Huxtable, the Fat Albert kids, all of these things have been taken away from us.
Yeah.
And marred, and with your act, you have taken a step to take them back.
Yeah.
I like that. Okay. I'll be saying that at the festival.
Teresa, thank you so much for being on the show.
It is definitely that. The final, I'm not going to talk about what happens in the final chapter of the book, but each chapter in the book is through the lens of a different character. The final chapter is through Cliff's own voice. So it's what happens in the moment of his death. So entire book is addressing having lost Cliff. The final chapter is the loss of Cliff. And in that loss, he's not the only one. In that loss, we see Fat Albert. We see Little Bill. We see Hilton Lucas. We see the character he played in I Spy.
Right.
I just drew a blank on his name. I can grab the book.
That's okay.
In the final chapter of the book, it really is a moment of burning down the legacy that I'm not necessarily burning it down, but there's a way that I handle all of those various characters confronting Bill Cosby. So in this universe, Bill Cosby and Cliff Huxtable coexist.
Right.
Two separate individuals. And that's the separation work. That's the healing work. That's the work where, you know, I'm getting a lot of reviews and a lot of comments from folks saying, I just didn't have the context or the means to really see a separation, but especially when you get to that point where you see all of his work laid out and it's all at his hand, at Cosby's hand, being burned to the ground, it releases a lot of the tension I have around it. And now I can go back and binge watch The Cosby Show without feeling like, you know,
like you're doing something dirty.
Doing something dirty. I've made that separation. I know the character that I see on television is not the actual man, you know, so.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Teresa, and we will definitely be in attendance at the Festival of the Book.
Awesome, awesome. And congratulations to you on your book. I've been following your progress and your success, and I'm so excited for you and happy for you and proud of you. And when I see you, I'm anticipating seeing you on Sunday at the very least. I'm
yes.
going to have my book in hand and I'm going to crave your autograph. So let's get prepared for that.
Okay, and then I get to do my weird, like, you know, fan crazed, you know, and be in awe of you.
it'll certainly be mutual, trust. And Clinton, I just want to see your face and hug you soon, too. I miss you, brother.
I miss you, my dear.
Right.
Thanks, Teresa. Right.
Thank you.
Teresa Dalvest, Death of Cliff Huxtable, coming at you on Homegrown 94.7. Homegrown, show about local art. Now you know. Let's talk about some other things that you need to know about coming up. Today's the last day for Hands on a Hard Body. No, it's not gay porn. By Shannon Arts in Stanton, a musical about today's American middle class beaten down and economically deprived. Based on a real Texas competition where a group of people have to keep one hand on a pickup truck and whoever lasts the longest gets to keep the truck. Fascinating. That's over at Shannon Arts in Stanton. I had tickets for it this week, but the allergens attacked and kept me from going. Don't be like me. Don't miss out your last chance. Today is an artist talk and a poetry reading at Kroeber Project's Art Laboratory. Also today is Drink and Draw at the Ix Art Park. Currently running right now until March 20th, Moon Over Buffalo at Four County Player is a wonderful farce coming straight to us from Broadway. And also currently running, and you should know this if you listened to our show last week because we talked to the director, Fran Smith, about this. Currently running right now until April 3rd at Live Arts. It's To Kill a Mockingbird, a classic novel put into play form. From March 16th to 20th, guess what? Virginia Festival of the Book. We've already started talking about it. And we're probably going to talk about it some more. March 17th, it's story time at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center, and I bet you this is part of the Festival of the Book. The Girl Who Carried Too Much Stuff, read by the author, Mark Boston, from 2 to 3 p.m. Also on the 17th, Big Blue Door Improv Night at Seaville Coffee. And from the 17th to the 6th to April 16th, Thursdays and Saturdays during that time period, it's No Wake, a multimedia outdoor performance and dance installation piece at the Ix Art Park by Jennifer Hoyt Tidwell, the 2015-2016 public artist for the Bridge Progressive Arts Initiative. On the next day, March 18th, it's Battling Contra Dances, Seville Contra Dance at the Municipal Arts Center and Contra Dance at the Front Porch Roots Music School. How will you ever decide? I don't know. March 19th, Open Mic Comedy featuring Chris Allen at Fellini's. March 31st to April 9th, The Arctic Circle and A Recipe for Swedish Pancakes, a play at UVA done by the UVA Drama Department and written by a UVA alum, Samantha Mocker. March 31st, speaking of plays, to April 10th, Polaroid Stories at our favorite Guerrilla Theater. Greek myth meets modernity on the fringes of urban society. Check that out. And speaking of checking these out, tickets are on sale now for April 10th to 11th, the Shenandoah Fringe Festival in Stanton, Virginia. Tickets at shenfringe.com. And let's look at just some of the music that you can kick back and deal with. Today, O Stella Maris, Music for Women's Voices by Zephyrus, Central Virginia's early music vocal ensemble. Tonight, Travis Elliott at Rapture. March 15th, Red and the Romantics at Dirty Nelly's. And March 15th, an open mic night at Holly's Deli and Pub. Lots of music playing on the 17th. Oh my goodness. The Sally Rose Band opening up for Lord Nelson at Three Notch Brewing Company. Albemarle Pipes and Drums will be at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub at 8 and then at Fellini's at 8:30. So if you see a bunch of people walking down Market Street with pipes and drums, don't bug them. They're trying to get to a gig. March 17th, also, King Golden Banshee at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub after the pipes and drums have had their say. Also, Cashless Society at the Whiskey Jar and the Central Virginia Blues Society Acoustic Jam at Star Hill Brewery Tap Room. The next day, March 18th, if you haven't had your music fill yet, Moby and the Dicks at Firefly and Open Music Jams at the James River Brewery and the Robert Joss Bay Express Trio at Glasshouse Winery. March 19th, it's second draw at Pro Reynada Farm Brewery and La Unica at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. They're from D.C. That's kind of local. I thought I would go with that. Tickets are on sale now for Amuse Bouche by the Victory Hall Opera Company for their April 17th performance. And, of course, every Monday night, it's the singer-songwriter night at the local. Every Wednesday, it's Bob Bonetta at Cafe Cultura. And also, it's the Mike Rosensky and Jeff Decker Quartet at Miller's and Jim Wave at the Blue Moon Diner. Every Thursday, it's the Woolen Writers Revival, hosted by Will Thomas Reed and Brian Craddock at Firefly. And if you're not in the mood for that, come back downtown to Miller's and hear the John Dearth Quintet, because every once in a while, you just got to come down to Dearth. And that is just some of the many, many wonderful artistic things going on in this wonderfully artistic town. If you're an artist and have an event and can fight through the allergens and you want us to talk about it, contact us, www.facebook.com/homegrownwpvc, or email it to us at homegrown947@gmail.com. Let us tell our people about your stuff. You don't. 32 minutes past the hour. You're here with Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC, Barrassa Voice of Charlottesville. Stay tuned. It's the Sunday morning wake-up call after this with your host, Rick Moore. Today, he's talking with Mary Jean Jaggers about her book, 100 Things to Do in Charlottesville Before You Die. Now, here's the thing. I think that it probably would sell better if it were 100 people to do in Charlottesville before you die. But nobody...
Clinton?
What? What? Oh, I forgot this is...
Are we working blue today?
This was a Judeo-Christian Islamic culture with severe taboos against sex and nudity. Sorry about that.
Wow. Okay. Well, I guess, you know, you're allowed to work blue. Last week I did it. This week you do it.
Hey, I'm always working black, baby. I'm always working black.
Always. All right. So put your fists up when you say that. All right. On to our next guest. We are absolutely excited to have Bernard Hankins and Chance Dickerson from Rhyme and Design with the Bridge Pie A3 House at... What is this? You're doing like initials here. Write things out if you expect me to read them. AHS?
Yeah. High school.
What?
Albemarle High School.
Albemarle High School. Thank you. Thank you, Chance. Thank you. He just puts initials. I'm like, what in the heck?
No, don't do that. Everybody knows AHS for Child Mahomes.
Oh, everyone knows
Everybody
that?
Knows.
Well, I didn't know.
I can't help that.
You can't help that?
I can't help
that. You could have helped it if you'd written it out. I'm just saying. Oh, my goodness. Welcome. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So you guys are doing a special project at Albemarle High School. So tell us about it.
So just to kind of break things up. So Rhyme and Design is a project that I started birthed out of a bigger project. My business partner and friend Daniel Garner have a company called Cypher, where we use hip-hop to develop brand names. So then we have a child or youth version of that called Rhyme and Design. So it's basically taking kids who already have hip-hop talent and showing them how to use that in a design context so they can economically empower themselves. And so I did that for the first time last year over the summer with a grant from the Bridge Progressive Arts Initiative, Matt Slatz. So they helped fund that. And now we're going to be taking that with Chance over here at A3 House at Albemarle High School.
And so interestingly, simultaneously while Bernard was starting Rhyme and Design through Cypher, Albemarle County Public Schools started this initiative called the Maker Education Initiative, which uses project-based learning to encourage kids and to learn in an innovative way and to really think outside the box. And so they installed a recording studio inside the Media Center, and I started running that last year. And interestingly enough, Bernard and I have a background together with poetry and hip-hop and the local music scene. So it just sort of made sense to sort of fuse these two programs together in a way. And so we decided to bring Rhyme and Design to A3 House.
So the thing that strikes me the most about it is that you both, when we were first talking about it, you both talked in the same way about how hip-hop and the recording and the mixing and just the development, not just the enjoyment of it, but the creation of it and the use of it. There were these skills that these kids had. Bernard, you were saying that there were these skills that these kids had that nobody was really seeing a use for. Chance, you're saying that there are these kids who had these skills and had these interests that the school wasn't really focused on.
Yeah, I mean, think about what you guys are doing right here in the radio station, pushing buttons, doing announcements, making advertisements. It's like these kids are already in the studio in front of microphones. Just no one has ever said, hey, let me put you in a context with, you know, a commercial component.
So you can make money at it.
Yeah. Part of it is, you know, a lot of the stereotypes attached to hip hop make people say, oh, we don't want to be around that. So there's an instant fear to kind of reject that.
Yes.
But when you put people in a context where you say, oh, wow, this kid is amazing with wordplay, why don't I let them name my product? And they're going to come up with 100 names in a day, whereas it's going to take me a week, giving them the opportunity. Given the opportunity for the kids to be used, but also opportunity for business people to be like, oh, wait, we're missing out on valuable opportunities.
Well, yeah, valuable opportunities not only to help them grow their business and product, but also, I'm sure, what the kids would charge for their copy creation, you know, tagline creation is a lot less than if they went to, you know, let's say a marketing firm to do it.
Right. And then you get that whole feel good. I'm helping out the community,
right,
and youth,
right,
and children, and everybody wins.
Everybody wins. So how many kids do you have involved in the program right now?
Right now at A3 House, we have about 50, 55 kids enrolled in the actual audio production classes. Probably another 100 kids that come and use the studio throughout the day because it is an open space of creativity. From that pool of say 200 to, you know, 250 kids, we have about 15 that are dedicated to working with Rhyme and Design and coming in and staying after school and working on the marketing aspect and using their music to fine tune their marketing skills.
That's so great. That's a lot of kids going through that program.
Yeah.
So what's the next step? Like, so you've got these kids, they know how to run a board, they know how to navigate all that. They have their talent in creating taglines and like, let's say, you know, musical jingles and things like that. So how do you move them from the studio into real life and show them not only how to make their artwork for them, but to get paid for it? Like, how do you get them to out in the real world?
Well, I mean, honestly, I think part of that is going to be on them. Like, I see myself, my strength is kind of being the catalyst. I'm not the person who's like, this is how you convert dollars into cents, you know? I'm the person who's like, look, you have something important, you have something of talent, you can do something with it. So I'm definitely the inspirational creative mind.
Right.
And so I'm here to spark kids to be like, wait a minute, no one has ever shown me that I could do this. And so now I have an example of a person telling me that. Now I need to figure out, okay, what do I need to do? I need to go to the counselor. Do I need to go talk to my dad? Do I need to go to Mr. Dickerson and ask him what's available out there? So I think part of that is up to them, and I'm really just trying to make them see that they themselves are already entrepreneurs that just haven't been shown that.
I've kind of taken a similar approach. Like when I first started teaching, you know, there's this this vibe around there being an adult kind of lecturing students, and you assume this authoritative figure, which I always hated in school. It's one of the reasons why I hated school and didn't want to go to school. So in the classroom, I try to, like Bernard said, be more of a catalyst, not talking to students, not telling them how to do something, but listening to them and saying, okay, I see you rapping, I see you designing, I see you drawing graffiti. How can I just give you some resources or point you in the right direction without saying, this is your assignment, this is what you do? So really it's like a hands-off approach. And so it can be with Rhyme and Design. It can be saying, hey, you want to play some music at Seville Coffee on Tuesday night? Let's set that up for you. Like, it's your job. You're the artist. You're the guy with the ideas. Let me just open some doors for you.
And I think that's hard for like a school system to understand, yeah, or a structure.
Right, because I was about to say, you're facilitating creativity and instigating agency on their part. That's not the school that I remember.
Yeah. And they're not getting graded on it? Whoa. Pull back.
Well, I think the hard thing for like a structural minded person to get is the creative person likes to figure it out. They like to discover. They like to tap into the unknown. So when you say, here's the answer, they're like, okay, thanks, now I'm bored. So for the kid looking for what to do, they kind of like to just be pushed to the edge and then be like, okay, thanks, I got it from here.
Right.
You know, what that reminds me of? I go to a strange place, or at least a place that I didn't expect to go. David Bowie just died. I remember watching an interview with David Bowie, and he was talking about getting synthesizers when synthesizers were first coming, and he was laughing. He was saying that the synthesizer companies didn't understand. Like, they would give them these synthesizers, and the synthesizers would come with all of these sounds pre-programmed into them,
yep,
and those instruction books. And he said, we would throw the instruction books out and start taking it apart. We weren't concerned. We didn't care about what was pre-programmed. We want to know what really cool things we could do once we broke the thing. Right?
Yeah, I always hated that. When I got musical instruments, they'd be like, here's all these pre-filled patterns. I'm like, you've just taken up all the space for the stuff I wanted to record. I don't need 90 like company factory-made patterns. I want 90 of my own beats.
Right. Yeah. This is so, so smart. Because in such an information-rich society, in such an information-rich culture that is getting more and more about data coming to us, and also malleable data, it seems like teaching kids, teaching people in general, but specifically teaching kids that, you know, skills in terms of manipulating data and manipulating sounds and manipulating media, it seems like it's got to be base knowledge. It's something we should be doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you guys have read Daniel Pink's A Whole New Mind, but he basically talks about how the right brainers are going to rule the future because America's got to the point where they've got so much stuff, but now they're bored. So
right.
Now they're looking for meaningful experiences. He's like, everything's being automated or sent overseas. So what can you provide that a robot can't provide?
Exactly.
So if you don't have anything unique of yourself to bring, you're going to be left without something to do because we're somebody or some robot's taking your job.
So what kind of kid? I'm interested in the mix of kids because, I mean, Albemarle High School is kind of a hodgepodge of our community.
On,
so what?
No, let me jump in really quickly.
What?
I'm not going to be able to say this once you say this really quickly. If you're just tuning in, 44 minutes past the hour, we're in a great conversation with Bernard Hankins and Chance Dickerson. Bernard Hankins, who started Rhyme and Design. Chance Dickerson is doing the A3 House at Albemarle High School, AHS. Stay tuned afterwards, of course, Sunday morning with Wake Up Call with Rick Moore. Go.
He literally pushed me out of the way. Okay. So what kinds of different kids are involved in the program?
You're absolutely right about Albemarle being a really diverse, culturally diverse school, but a lot of their programs in the arts, the ones that are well known, like band, chorus, are slowly starting to incorporate that diversity. I think there's, you know, this stereotype that band students are Caucasian, that chorus students are Caucasian, drama yes. students. And so there's a whole demographic, and it's poor kids, it can be kids of color, it can be kids from different countries that have amazing talent, have creativity and skills and aspirations and passions, but they come to school and they're like, well, maybe I don't belong in that room because yes. they don't look like me or they yes. don't talk like me. So I'm not going to try out. So I think what the A3 House did was kind of really encourage everyone to come in. And I think by giving kids the freedom of designing their work environments, like we told kids to come in and paint the walls. Like kids painted the walls, whatever colors they wanted. They brought their own equipment in. They saw a funny chair that they wanted to sit in. They brought that in. And so it just was like 100% their space. And I think because of that, we had just so many different kinds of kids there. And then with the music and the marketing aspect, it takes a very high level of intelligence to yeah. run these pieces of equipment. To know what does an audio interface do? What does a compressor do? And so that attracts the kids from these like tech backgrounds that are like writing code for computers right. and designing websites. So like, hey, this is kind of interesting. So now we have a kid who writes code who's in like the Mesa program sitting down next to a kid who would just be going home after school and like playing Xbox from a totally different background, and they're like working together. Like one's providing the sound, one's providing the rap, one's providing the production and the engineering. So it's really just across the board, like a wide range of kids from all
That's
different places.
Awesome. And the reason I asked that question is because when I was in high school, I had that kind of environment with theater. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my drama director was like that. She basically gathered all of the kids that didn't easily fit into the high school boxes, you know, and made us a family. Right. And those kids, we are still friends today. Mm-hmm. And so those bonds are going to, you know, serve those kids through their entire lives, and they're going to end up working together and creating years and years in the future. And that's really cool.
I mean, that's another, I think, added benefit. I think as a creative person, you don't wake up saying, how can I be diverse today? Let me go meet a white person and then a black person. Creative people just like all types of things. So when they end up doing those things, they cross paths with people who do those same things that happen to be different. So the things that, you know, schools and government try to force, hey, we need to get everybody together. Creative people are like we're already doing,
yeah.
like we naturally do because we don't care.
Yeah, we just, already here.
Like
we
when
good.
When I show up, my first question is like, what about you is interesting that I can engage with? Oh, great. You rap too? Oh, great. You're going to make my song hot. Yeah, let's work together versus, oh, there's this black person. I should go. No, like that force thing creative people can't stand. And you don't even need to do it because it happens naturally when people, you know, surround around this thing that everybody can do.
I love that image of somebody waking up going, whom shall I meet today? Well, yesterday was an African-American. So was the day before that.
Chick.
It's been a while since I've met an Asian. Maybe a South Sea Islander.
So, yeah, I mean, schools really want like all this diversity to happen. It's like, put some music in front of somebody. Like, music itself is diverse.
Language. Yeah.
Yeah, Indeed, and it's interesting because I think still, even today, so much of the image of hip-hop is as a black thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at hip-hop, the more I see, especially looking at local hip-hop, there's so many people doing it. And it's become a worldwide phenomenon. And it's big in so many different cultures, and it speaks to people in so many different cultures that, I mean, you know, as African Americans, we're never going to take our name off of it. It's like, yeah, we did that. You're welcome.
Right.
But, you know, to just look at it as as being a racially uniform thing, I think is behind the times.
Yeah, and well, you look at hip hop, you look at a lot of them, predominantly black art, it is the type of art that demands people's attention and demands that they open their minds and mix and mingle with other people. That's why hip hop is spread across the entire globe. That's why blues is spread across the Atlantic Ocean. That's why, you know, that's why black art changes culture and society so easily, because it demands a redesign of your psyche. And so I
love that. Demands a redesign of your psyche. We are
so mic drop sound.
Right? Mic drop. Done. Thank you.
Your students need to give us a mic drop sound. So we just need
that. Well, yeah, like kind of riffing off with Chance, I was going to inject this idea of, you know, empathy in hip hop, which people probably never think about. But I went to this lecture several years ago, and this guy said something very interesting. He said, hip-hop is the only genre that says opera, rock, Irish, Celtic,
right,
Mexican, come in, because it samples.
No
other art form uses sampling as a technique to borrow from every other culture. You may have like a little, you know, conga line or some conga drum in a rock song, but you don't have anybody saying, I'm going to take a hip-hop, opera, 70s children's music and put it all in the same thing. And when you're forced to listen to other people, you have to learn about
it and make it work. And it, and when all of those things converge, you're right, it does force you to be like, oh wait, what's that music behind that? That's awesome.
When you're looking at hip-hop, like, we always think, especially now, hip-hop is the music, it's the beat and the guy rapping, but that's not how it was started. It was the dance, it was the breakdancing, the graffiti, the art, the just the passion. It's not just one art form.
Yeah, it was started as a community coming together. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So when you have like Rhyme and Design, when you have A3 House, it's hip hop. Even if there's no rap being played or made, it's hip hop.
It's hip hop. Yes.
We're taking like art and music and putting it together and creating products. Like, that's hip hop.
That is awesome. Thank you guys so much for coming in and talking to us about it. And we will definitely be asking some of your students. Maybe they want to come in, volunteer at the station.
Absolutely.
Get some real world experience.
Get some of those ads played on
get
here.
Get some of those ads played. That'd be great. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
All right.
Thank you.
52 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC. You're listening to me getting slapped up, down, and all around by the antihistamines that I'm on, the high-powered antihistamines that I'm on. Stay tuned after our show, because as with every Sunday, it's the Sunday morning wake-up call. The Sunday, your host, Rick Moore, taking a peek into the upcoming events of the Virginia Festival of the Book, talking to Mary Jean Jaggers, 100 Things to Do in Charlottesville Before You Die. And one thing that we need to do before we die metaphorically today is check in with Leslie for everyone's favorite part of the show, Leslie's weekly rant.
Aw, thank you, Clinton. There is nothing better than finishing a project. There's no greater feeling than writing that last word, that last note, putting that last finishing touch on a painting, or carving that last bit of useless material away from a sculpture. As artists, we revel in the finishing of something. We complain through the whole process about the hours of work and the time spent churning this thing we call art out of us, but we secretly enjoy every moment. Then finally, it's done. Our child has legs, arms, and a strong heartbeat, and we send it off into the world to live on its own. And much like a parent, we spend time wishing we had taught it something more. We wish we had made them take that coat, or at times, a gun to protect them from the cruel, cruel world that won't understand. We think of how we should have, could have changed things, how we could have made it better, more succinct, or more dazzling. It's another curse of the artist. Once this wonderful thing we've created is, in air quotes, finished, we immediately start thinking of what we should have done differently. It is striving for perfection, but not in the sense that most people think. We are striving for it to be more engaging, clearer to our audience, more, just more. This weekend, I had the first signing for my novel, and amidst the hustle, bustle, and nervous energy, I kept thinking of how I could change it. How could I make it better? How could I make sure this story that I created was well understood? And at the end of the question and answer session, I was hit in the face with two things. One, it is what it is. I have done something that I had always dreamed of doing, publishing a book. It's done. And I need to enjoy that accomplishment. Two, was quite terrifying that I would now have to do this again. As people clapped in praise of me, I was almost knocked off my feet with the terror that I may not be able to reproduce what I have slaved over. What if this was all that was in me? What if this was it, my magnum opus? Then another remarkable thing happened. I looked at my daughter, my mother, my friends all around me, rooting for me. And suddenly it was okay. I knew another story just as real and powerful as the one I had created would come to me. My muse would visit me again. It would visit me again because I had a rich, full, and blessed life from which to draw. And no matter what, it would be okay. More importantly, on the drive home, I had an idea. There's another book in me. Another play, another song to be sung, another child to gestate and bring into the world. My opus has not yet been imagined. And that's the weekly rant.
Really?
Yep.
Really?
Really? You have a problem with me realizing that I have more work in me?
Well, one, I don't know how that really constitutes itself as a rant. But also, I mean, come on.
What?
I mean, Hillary Clinton gives out the gaffe of all gaffes in her political career, and you're just going to let that one slide? That wasn't going to be the rant.
You know, I'm just kind of tired of talking about Hillary. Like, I'm so over
really?
Her. I'm so
really?
Over
I
it.
Mean, if,
I'm
if,
over it.
If this election process weren't so ridiculous as it is, if there weren't so much ludicrous stuff going on, this could possibly have been her Dukakis on the tank moment.
No,
but
no.
You know, she'll probably. But yeah, like you didn't talk. What?
I didn't because you know,
this was
like
this
I said, I'm
this
done.
Wasn't close
I,
enough for you. This
kinda,
wasn't interesting enough for
I'm
you.
I'm kind of over Hillary.
I cannot believe that. You know, I had money on this being.
You had money on
I
this.
I had money.
That you on this bet being, on what my thing. Rants are going to be about
I
on
was.
A weekly basis.
Of course I do. What are you talking about? I got to get something from these goddamn rants that I got to sit through every freaking week, and I made. Bucks last week.
Wait a minute.
I made
you don't,
bucks
wait,
last
wait, wait.
Week. And so I put it all.
Something?
I put it all
you
on this one.
Something
thinking
just,
that
I don't
I'm
know,
like,
listening
I'm
going to
let it ride. I was going to let it ride.
Oh,
and
my
then,
God.
And
Clinton.
Then you do this. Do you realize I'm out? I'm out of everything. Everything. Okay.
He's out
fine.
Of everything.
Fine. So it's like,
yeah.
no, you just
okay.
got to pass.
It
was
fine,
there.
Clinton.
It was a gift.
Be
it
upset.
It was a gift.
Right.
Hillary Clinton's just like Nancy Reagan helping AIDS. I mean, really? Just,
I know.
Well, fine. Now I got to go and take the bus home because I can't
take the bus home. You drove here. How much sense does that make? All right. Well, another week ending with Clinton being upset at me. Oh, well, that's how it happens, ladies and gentlemen. Well, you guys. It's been great. It's been grand. You have an absolutely wonderful week ahead of you. We want to thank our guests, Teresa Dalvest, and Chance Dickerson and Bernard Hankins for coming in and talking to us. Rick Moore is up next. Thank you so much. We will see you next week.
And hoist it high. Let's make this moment last. So what we celebrate, seeing another day. You bring the champagne. You bring the Chardonnay. I'll bring the champagne.